coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. While the Trump administration slows movement on regulating so-called forever chemicals in water, Delaware lawmakers seek to fill the void.
Even though the bill, as you say, does not explicitly set PFAS health limits in Delaware water supplies, it's encouraging the public to advocate for its own protection.
Contributor John Hurdle looks at new legislation to address PFAS in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about a bill trying to better regulate multi-level marketing companies. Arts Playlist takes us to the latest exhibition at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery. And Enlighten Me features stories from University of Delaware student journalists. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The future of regulating and mitigating so-called forever chemicals in drinking water appears to be in limbo nationwide. During the Biden administration, the EPA enacted strict limits on a laundry list of PFAS chemicals and a timeline to start enforcing those limits. But the Trump administration is pushing that timeline back and scrapping limits on some forms of the chemicals for now, raising concerns about the ultimate fate of those Biden-era limits. Locally, some state lawmakers are taking steps they believe will help ensure Delaware manages any PFAS contamination issues in line with the Biden-era rules. This week, contributor John Hurdle examines what the Trump administration's approach on PFAS means for the first state and how Delaware is responding in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And John joined me this week to discuss what he learned. John, I think the best place to start is where things stood before the Trump administration took office. What were the PFAS limits created by the Biden administration's EPA, and how did they compare to the levels Delaware was contemplating before the Biden administration created those levels?
Well, what the Biden administration did was to set health limits for six PFAS. And the most headline grabbing, if you like, were its very strict limits for two of the most commonly found types of PFAS chemicals. Those are called PFOA and PFOS. And what the Biden administration did was to set very strict limits on those things. That was four parts per trillion. And what I'm hearing from the scientific community is that is right down at the lowest detection limit. You might say that was an indication of the seriousness with which the Biden administration took these chemicals in drinking water as a threat to public health. So this was the first national standard. Yes, they were much lower. These levels for PFOA and PFOS were much lower than what Delaware had previously proposed. There was a bill going through the legislature which proposed health limits of 21 and 14 parts per trillion, respectively, for those two chemicals. And of course, that was overtaken by the national standards when they were published first in 2023. And then there was the Biden administration also set levels for four other PFAS chemicals. So that was, they set, essentially what the Biden administration did was to set a very high bar for PFAS regulation across the country.
And John, what was the timeline for enforcement of those Biden-era limits? And were Delaware utilities and Delaware on track to kind of meet that deadline?
Well, what the Biden EPA set 2027 as the time when utilities would have to inform the EPA about any violations of the limits that they had set, and that any violations would be enforced starting 2 years after that. In terms of what the Delaware utilities have done, about a year ago, Veolia, which is one of the state's leading water utilities, they published their plans for setting up a PFAS filtration unit at Wilmington, and they've currently they have a request pending at the Public Service Commission for an increase of almost $60 million in the rates that they would charge, and some of the revenue from that, if it's approved by the PSC, would be used for the cost of installing PFAS filtration at their public water plants. Artesian, which is another major water utility in Delaware, they said that they've been testing for PFAS since 2013.
The Trump administration is obviously taking a different approach. What is it doing with these limits going forward?
Well, the Trump administration has essentially done two things. It has delayed the enforcement of the Biden limits on PFOA and PFOS. Remember, those were the two chemicals that had the strictest health limits imposed on them. And so the Trump EPA has delayed implementation of those standards for by 2 years until 2031. But significantly, perhaps, the Trump administration has upheld those limits. This may be an indication of the seriousness with which even an administration that is very radically anti-regulation, this may be an indication of that they recognize the serious threat to public health posed by these chemicals. And of course, that's what advocates have been calling for years and years. As to the other four chemicals that had been regulated by the Biden administration, the Trump EPA has rescinded those standards and said that they will be subject to some regulatory review. Advocates for strict health limits on PFAS chemicals in general have called this an abandonment of the government's responsibility to protect public health.
So some of the Biden-era limits are sticking, some are not, and everything is being kind of pushed down the road a little bit, which brings us to where we are right now. And Delaware's response to all this appears to be Senate Bill 72, which has passed the Senate, still awaits action in the House. Tell us a little bit about what SB 72 does, John, in terms of regulating PFAS locally.
Well, if this becomes law, this will require the Division of Public Health to set up a website showing any PFAS content in local water systems that exceeds the Biden-era limits. And in addition, it would require the DPH to inform utilities if MCLs are exceeded.
And so the bill isn't technically creating enforceable limits with penalties, as Delaware had considered previously. But I guess what it's doing is effectively making the Biden-era limits for all six PFAS categories the state standard, correct?
Yes, it is. That's correct. I spoke with Senator Darius Brown, the chief sponsor of this bill, and he confirmed that the Biden standards would apply. And he it it also I mean he points out that the bill's language quote empowers Delaware residents to advocate for safer water, and so even though the bill is not, as you say, does not explicitly set PFAS health limits in Delaware water supplies, it's encouraging the public to advocate for its own protection.
I guess the theory being that if, you know, the utilities have to tell the public, hey, your water is above the limit, that the pressure from the public for them to do something about it would be the stick as opposed to fines and penalties.
Well, absolutely. I think that the as the bill's language indicates, then it's encouraging encouraging water customers to advocate for the purity of their own water supplies.
And the timeline for this going into effect, if it is passed, is pretty quick, right? So unlike the Trump administration, which seems to be pushing things out, this bill would actually kind of make things happen pretty quickly.
Well, it would. The bill overall would become effective 90 days after becoming law. And that means that the health limits would become enforceable by 2029. And the significance of that is that that's 2 years before the Trump EPA would require that enforcement. I mean, we probably should say at this point that it's the advocates and the supporters of this bill are pretty optimistic that it is actually going to become law. It became It was passed unanimously by the Senate in recent weeks. It's now due for a hearing by a House committee. Senator Brown said he was optimistic that the legislature as a whole would approve it and that it would be signed by the governor.
And you mentioned the water quality advocates. I mean, do they feel this is sufficient, that this kind of will get the job done, even if there isn't necessarily limits that are enforceable set by the state itself?
Well, indeed, I spoke with Dr. Jerry Kaufman. He's a longtime advocate for the for stricter PFAS limits. He's the director of the University of Delaware's Water Resources Center, he welcomed this bill as a sign that Delaware was taking the initiative on behalf of its residents at a time when the federal government is retreating.
How about the water utilities? You mentioned earlier, you know, they have been making some moves on mitigating and testing for PFAS in their systems. You know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, Veolia is saying that, hey, you know, we're putting in stuff that's going to cost some money. We may ask the ratepayers to pay a little bit more to help us pay for that, but something is happening. Does this impact them in any way from your discussions with them, this bill, SB 72?
Well, the response that I got from Artesian was pretty sanguine. It said it did not expect to have to be significantly affected by SB 72, and perhaps because it's confident that, as their spokesman pointed out, that they've been testing for PFAS since 2013, so they're aware of the nature of the threat. And presumably, they think that they will be able to comply with the levels that would be effectively set by SB 72.
As we wrap up, John, is there a sense why this is the approach rather than revisiting the previous PFAS legislation, creating a state standard that was being considered before the Biden era limits were announced? And is that something the state could still look at down the road?
Well, it seems unlikely that the state would go back to its earlier proposals, because you know what we've got here is the state now saying that they want to apply the Biden era proposals, which it's certainly in the case of PFOA and PFOS are much stricter than anything that the state previously aimed at. And so the idea here is that this is more protective. By adhering to those stricter limits, this will be more protective of public health at a time than that you know, there is ongoing concern about the very negative health effects that these chemicals have when they show up in drinking water.
And clearly they feel like the reporting of it is enough, you know, that they don't need to go down that road of enforceable limits with penalties and fines.
What they're hoping is that the public gets it, that if the public has an easy to use website that shows them specifically what the PFAS levels are of these various chemicals in their own local water supply, then that's going to motivate them to advocate for themselves.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece, Updating Delaware's Work to Address PFAS in the First State, is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Our state politics reporter Sarah Petrowich reports on a new legislative effort to tighten regulations on multi-level marketing companies. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware could become one of the strictest states when it comes to disclosure requirements around multi-level marketing companies, commonly referred to as MLMs. These types of businesses operate under a model where individuals sell products directly to consumers while also recruiting others to join the company. State Representative Melanie Ross Levin believes these companies are often misrepresenting how much an individual can profit, and her legislation would create stricter guidelines to ensure distributors are not being taken advantage of. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich spoke with Ross Levin, as well as legal experts and individuals directly affected by MLM companies, to better understand how this bill would work.
Multi-level marketing companies have been around since the late 1800s, but began picking up real steam following World War II in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. MLMs presented an opportunity for women to gain some financial independence as they became increasingly interested in entering the workforce, and MLM's target demographic remains the same today, often single women with children looking for financial freedom. Big MLM names like Mary Kay and Avon, both beauty cosmetic companies, operate through a network of consultants who purchase products at wholesale price and profit by selling them directly to customers at retail. But consultants can expand their income by recruiting others to join their sales teams, earning additional commissions on their downline sales. MLMs gained a second wind following the boom of social media, allowing companies to recruit at higher volumes and sell products more effectively. But the spike has also led to more women coming forward about negative experiences. While MLMs are a legitimate business model, some operate closer to what's referred to as a pyramid scheme, which focuses primarily on recruiting new members and less on products.
I was only 18 years old, with two brand new babies to raise all on my own when I was recruited into Mary Kay. Bright-eyed, eager, and completely unaware of the financial trap I was stepping into. I was sold a dream of financial freedom, community, and empowerment. What I got instead was thousands of dollars in debt, hours of unpaid labor, and the shame of having unknowingly roped in friends and family who trusted me.
That's Christina Kelly, who spoke in favor of State Representative Melanie Ross Levin's bill during its committee hearing. It's stories like Christina's that inspired Ross Levin to write the bill, which would mandate MLMs to disclose a complete description of its compensation plan, including inventory purchase requirements, before an individual signs on. It would also allow participants to cancel their contracts for any reason within 3 months, and upon cancellation, require the MLM to repurchase all unsold goods in reasonable condition at least 90% of the original price.
A lot of times you're put under pressure to sign up and you might have second thoughts. And I really want people to be able to financially recover from these situations and be able to get out of these situations if they need to. There's really a huge disadvantage to the consultants versus the company. The company makes money not only by selling product, but largely by selling product to consultants. And that's really why it's problematic.
Ross Levin's bill initially included a 48-hour cool-off period, which would have required a participant to wait 2 days before they could sign on with an MLM.
That was something that we had really strong opposition to, and just going through committee and talking to some of my colleagues, that piece, which no other state does, was going to be hard to kind of get to the finish line.
The original bill also included a provision that would have required MLMs to provide a disclosure statement that the state of Delaware does not approve, recommend, endorse, or sponsor any multi-level marketing program. Committee members felt this type of requirement was unusual, and Representative Ross Levin has since introduced a substitute version of the bill that removes both provisions. She says while not all MLMs are acting in predatory ways, she feels legislation like this is important to make sure the good actors remain good actors and the bad actors are held accountable. Douglas Brooks is a semi-retired Massachusetts-based lawyer who has litigated a number of class actions against MLMs and served as an expert witness during the bill's committee hearing. Douglas explains other types of businesses, like franchises, are subject to pre-sale disclosure requirements, but MLMs are exempt because the initial payment is often below the $500 threshold.
In 2012, the Federal Trade Commission passed what's called a business opportunity rule. Similar to the franchise rule, it requires pre-sale disclosures, a waiting period before people sign on the dotted line. But the multi-level marketing industry heavily lobbied to get exempted from that rule, and they were exempted from that rule. So where we are today is right now, multi-level marketing is the only type of business opportunity that is not subject to a pre-sale disclosure requirement. So I heartily support the Delaware bill, which would require pre-sale disclosures for prospective distributors. I think that there's really no legitimate argument why the multi-level marketing industry should not be subject to this type of rule that every other business opportunity is subject to.
Brian Harrison opposed the bill during its committee hearing. He's with the government affairs team for Amway, an MLM that claims to be the world's largest direct selling company via personal care and home products. Brian argues it's no longer common practice for MLMs to have inventory requirements and that most companies already have buyback policies. He took particular concern with how an MLM would calculate expected compensation, which would be a disclosure requirement under the new law.
It's very important how you calculate this. Some people come to the party and only want to buy the product and go home. Or they sign up because they want to get it at a discount. And so do you factor the person in who never makes another sale into what the average person is?
Parties are key to MLM's business models. Distributors host gatherings, often in their home, as an opportunity to promote the company to a group of invited guests and encourage others to become distributors of the products. Paula Randazzo is a Wilmington resident who became involved with Melaleuca in 2008, an MLM focused on personal care and home products. She was recruited by one of the clients of a small business she was running at the time.
She showed me all the products and invited myself, my husband, several times to her home with many people and showing videos and really sort of pushing, putting all the products out there all the time to show us how wonderful they were, health, beauty, household, that type of stuff. So I finally thought, you know, this could supplement the fact that I was trying to build a business of my own. Maybe this could supplement me to continue on. So I got involved in it, and before I knew it, I was buying hundreds and hundreds of dollars of products so that I would have them, so I could show them to people, so I could use them and tell them how they work and all of that. So, you know, my closet was filling up with all of this stuff. And on top of that, I had to get others to be under me, and it would go up the line and she would make more money. That's how it worked.
Paula says when she scheduled meetings with her family and friends to sell the products or recruit others, she was not allowed to tell prospective distributors that the woman that recruited her also insisted on coming along. Eventually, Paula and the recruiter went to visit Paula's cousin in New Jersey, who reluctantly signed with the MLM after hours of pressure.
By 6 o'clock in the morning, she must have stayed up all night. She wanted out of it. So I contacted the person I was dealing with, and I said to her that my cousin wants out. Can you just don't put it through today? I didn't think from 6 o'clock the night before to 6 o'clock in the morning that there would be an issue to cancel. You can't cancel.
Paula's recruiter told her to instead tell her cousin to use the products and to then go back to Melaleuca, say she didn't like them, and return them. Paula eventually found out her cousin returned the products at her own expense and received store credit that neither of them were initially made aware of. After calling and writing a letter to the corporate side of the company, Paula's cousin finally received her money back. But the incident has ruined Paula's relationship with her family to this day.
She got her money back. She was done with them. But she was done with me, because she somehow believed that I had done this. So that took care of the mother, her, the children, my whole side of the family over there were gone, because they thought, they were sure I had stolen the money from them.
Paula eventually left Melaleuca, but all the products she paid for out of pocket, she took as a loss. She says although she feels embarrassed about the entire experience and regrets involving her friends and family, she feels it's important to speak out about what she went through so more women can be made aware that they're not alone. Deborah Costas is a Wilmington resident who got involved with MLM Color Street Nail Strips in 2019. Although her experience wasn't as negative as Paula's, after months of not making nearly as much money as she'd hoped and being stuck with excess inventory, she left.
It's not a small thing. And when it doesn't work out, I did kind of feel like I failed a little bit especially when I saw how I didn't make any money. You know, it was fun. It was a learning experience. Like I said, for me, it was a distraction. But, you know, it's a big thing to feel like you started this thing and then you don't make money. You kind of feel like you failed. So having more, I think every company putting forth like the sheet that says what the likelihood, the percentage of making money, I think that's crucial. I think people need to see that.
Ross Levin's bill only cleared committee with Democratic support. Several of her male Republican colleagues argued the legislation is unnecessarily meddling in business operations and that not being successful is a risk all those involved in business take. But Ross Levin believes a lot of these companies target vulnerable women and say there's a gender divide when it comes to understanding that.
You know, what's interesting is so many of these companies are women focused, and actually all of the MLM executives I've met with have been men, and all of the women I've met in terms of being consultants have been you know, women. And so there's a bit of a gender divide. So when I talk to my female colleagues, they get it. I mean, we're invited as a woman. There's not a week that goes by that I'm not invited to a, you know, party, or I'm not solicited online by someone from high school. So it's a very women-focused industry. So what's interesting is that the women get it, and they've been supportive, and a bunch of the men have also been supportive. But, and this came up in committee, some of the men are just, they've never heard of this industry. They really are, you know, it's not on their radar. And so there does need to be a decent amount of education.
Despite Republican opposition, Representative Ross Levin is confident she can guide this bill across the finish line. It awaits a full vote on the House floor, and if passed, it will need to clear the Senate before heading to Governor Matt Meyer for signature. Sarah Petrowich, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sarah. And the Green continues next with Arts Playlist and a trip to the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington to check out the works of Wilmington artist Jen Hintz Eggers. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware artist Jen Hintz Eggers' work is influenced by her journey as a new mom, along with geometric pattern making and a simple, versatile shape. Her work is on display at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington's Carvel State Office Building through July 25th. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny speaks with Jen Hintz Eggers to learn more about her art and her current exhibition, Seeds of Life.
I'd like to start by asking you about the work that's on display and what visitors can expect to see.
Yeah, some of the paintings are a little bit older, so there's a little bit of a transition from painting about that's really centered on early motherhood, breastfeeding and nursing. There's a few paintings in there that feature my, what I call mammary flowers. They're abstracted mammary glands that when I was in medical settings and seeing these anatomical illustrations hung on the wall like you do in a doctor's office, I thought, oh my gosh, they look like flowers. That's crazy. And I just kind of like dove into that. So there's two paintings on display that have the mammary flowers featured paired with edible flowers. And I was really interested in this mirroring of the biological structures, the body structures, with these plant structures that are much more familiar. You know, a lot of us have seen an artichoke in the grocery store. You may have eaten a fig before and not known that it was a flower. So that kind of body nature connection and seeing the similarities of the shapes and forms between the two. And that's kind of led me down this line of looking at branching structures like blood vessels or trees. And it's kind of a little ambiguous which one is in the painting, which one I'm referencing. It does usually kind of lean towards trees. I spend a lot of time out in the woods, and that comes through in the work. So there's these, you know, bright colors and natural patterns.
The exhibition is called Seeds of Life, and you talked about part of it is an exploration of early motherhood. And I wonder, is that experience, do you think it's going to be a permanent part of your art, that it's baked into your creative psyche now, or is this something that will continue to evolve as your journey through motherhood evolves?
A bit of both, I think. You know, it's there's no going back now. You know, it's part of who I am. It's part of my life. It's that will never change. But also it changes all the time. And you know, the kids get more independent, they grow up, they move on. And that's the cycle of how parenthood works, right? I'm sure it will be there, but I'm sure it will also change. So whatever I am kind of immersed in at the time is what comes out in the artwork.
I wanted to ask you specifically in your art about the use and the significance of circles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's been in my work for so long, I'd be hard-pressed to give a real origin to it. It is the kind of universal symbol that exists in through cultures throughout history. It comes up again and again. It's a very simple symbol, right? And when I'm making the patterns, it's important to me that it be something that I can do fairly easily. I'm not a mathematician, and I don't want to spend my whole day doing the geometric tessellations that are all, very, very time consuming. And a circle is much easier. So I just use a straight edge and a compass to make the pattern. But you can get surprisingly intricate with just a straight edge and a compass. Even though it's very simple, you can also get very specific with what you're saying with that shape. So that's really kind of, that strikes me, right? Like that's something that I've spent a lot of time with. It just catches my interest that, this thing that is so simple, easy to repeat, but it's also very, very specific and very meaningful. And it suits the thoughts that I'm having when I'm making the work.
Are there particular artists or art movements that have been really influential to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I've spent a lot of time with kind of like the visionary art genre crew of contemporary artists. So that would be centered around Alex Gray and Allison Gray. They're husband and wife, and they have a wonderful community up in the Hudson Valley, New York. People might be more familiar with Alex Gray's work. He illustrated the artwork for Tool, the album covers for Tool. But I've also spent time with the pattern and decoration movement of the 70s. So in particular, Joyce Kozloff, she's an artist, a painter who works with a lot of patterns also, and specifically Middle Eastern background patterns and maps. She's done tile installations in local folks in Wilmington. If you've been to the train station, she has the tile installation that's on the entryway of the train station. I also spent some more time recently with Georgia O'Keeffe. It was one of those things that I kind of always like brushed it off, like, okay, yeah, sure. Everybody knows who Georgia O'Keeffe is. Everybody knows the flowers, yada, yada. But I really sat down and read like her biography and got like reading her writing and looking deeper into her huge portfolio of work. She's made so much work. And that's been a more recent inspiration, kind of deep dive into Georgia O'Keeffe.
Talk to me about your creative process and how art goes from idea to a finished piece.
It's actually a pretty long process. It doesn't happen all the time, but it has happened a few times that I will be sitting doing something completely unrelated, like in a thoughtful space, but not an art space. And I'll just have an idea. I'll have an image that kind of comes into my head and quick grab a sheet of paper, jot it down, scribble it out, and come back to it later. And then that turns into some small little sketches, little drawings, little paintings. And then it turns into, well, let's do it again, but this time bigger. Let's do it again, this time even bigger. And I just keep repeating it, changing it until it gets to something that I'm really happy with. So like in the current show that's at the mezzanine right now, that there's a series of five paintings called the Memento Vivere, and which means a reminder to live. I had this idea of cells multiplying, but using the seed of life pattern that I'm working with to create that kind of imagery. So, real quick, scribble it down in my sketchbook and come back to it, days, weeks later, and start to flesh out that idea and figure out how to make it to a finished piece. The other route of the process starts with looking at what's around me. I take like sketchbooks out into the woods. I do a lot of plein air sketching, or even if I'm just sitting in the diner, I might sketch like a light fixture. Or I've been known to sketch like architectural details, sign painting, like those kinds of decorative arts. And then like a motif will catch my attention or something along that lines. And I'm like, oh, there's something, I want to look into that further. I want to do something with this. I want to use this in some way. And so that becomes the basis of an artwork too.
I wonder, what's your ideal environment to work in?
I don't know if I have one. I think my ideal workspace is wherever I have time and space to do it. I do really love having these tall walls here that I can have bigger canvases. I haven't worked large in a long time. So some of the pieces that are in the mezzanine now, they're 30-inch by 40-inch canvases. That's the largest I've done like since college, maybe, because I finally have the space to actually set up a canvas that large. It's really refreshing to be able to kind of put my whole arm into a movement. Like I can really sweep a brush across the whole canvas, and that's a different experience. Like it's a different physical and sensory experience than painting small. But I also really love just perching on a rock with a tiny little 4-inch by 6-inch sketchbook and making a little drawing. Like that's kind of equally enjoyable to me.
And finally, what do you hope viewers will take away from seeing this exhibit?
Yeah, I think I really hope that people can see the work and take a minute with the work and really sit with it and let it just kind of remind you that life will go on. Sometimes things are really turbulent, really troublesome, and yet there's trees that are thousands of years old. And nobody really knows the future. And we're just going to find out. We're going to get through it. And that's really what the paintings are meant to be a reminder of, is that, yeah, some days are really hard, but also the cycles are long and they will continue.
Thanks to Wilmington area artist Jen Hintz-Eggers and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Jen Hintz-Eggers' solo exhibition, Seeds of Life, is on display through July 25th at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in the Carville State Office Building in Wilmington. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we highlight reporting by University of Delaware student journalists. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this edition of Enlighten Me, we head to the University of Delaware to highlight work from student journalists, pieces produced by UD Communication students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, longtime First Aid journalist, director of UD's journalism program, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with recent graduate Joe Cosmetti. The media communications major says many visitors to Delaware State Parks may be unaware of what those baskets with chains all around are used for. The answer is disc golf, and Cosmetti has more on this surprisingly popular game in Delaware.
For some, that's the sure sound of warmer weather, sports, and time with friends. It's the sound of sinking a putt in disc golf. And when summer hits, people turn to the game as one of America's lesser-known pastimes. For UD student Aiden Symington, it's about community.
There was a store on Main Street that like sold discs, and then like the more I played and I like introduced it to some of my friends here, like I realized there was a lot more people that played here and a lot bigger community.
For Aiden, that community is so notable because of how popular the game is in Delaware. The state of Delaware alone has 16 courses, 7 of them being in Delaware State Parks. So where did they all come from?
Well, I could give you the reason why it was originally started, and it sounds kind of terrible, but the superintendent up at Brandywine Creek told me that there were hippies in his parking lot throwing frisbees, and he wanted to give him a place to play.
That's the voice of Sean Heacock, chief of construction at Delaware State Parks, as he details how the game found a home in the first state.
The ones that are important are Cape and Lopen was the first in Delaware around about 1978, and it was in part designed by Ed Hedrick, who invented disc golf. So kind of a notable note there. And then Brandywine Creek was the second one that was installed sometime between 78 and 80. And then I know Brandywine Creek was the first tournament in Delaware in 1980.
And for Sean and the Parks Department, the installation of disc golf courses in state parks is a no-brainer.
I mean, really, it's just they're inexpensive and easy to put in and easy to maintain. But the cost to put a course in is you can put it in for less than $20,000 in the last 20 years. The bang for the buck is really, really valuable.
The pandemic brought another boom to the sport, leading to the first televised disc golf tournament, and the game has continued to grow in popularity since. Sean and the Parks Department report that Bellevue, the most popular course in Delaware, averages 1,500 rounds played a month. And that popularity for Aiden is all about the experience.
I love playing disc golf. I think it's a great way to get outside and hang out with your friends. And a lot of people don't realize it's a great form of exercise. You're walking for a while, but you don't even realize it because you're having fun.
And the game is a priority for the parks to upkeep. Within the past 5 years, all courses have undergone a major rehab, changing course layouts and upgrading equipment. So as long as people like Sean have a say, the game will continue to be a staple of the state parks of Delaware.
It takes somebody with the passion and effort to go through and do it. And then in 10 or 15, 20 years, whatever it may be, we'll go out and we'll shift things around again and make them fresh again.
For UD News, Joe Cosmetti reporting.
Thanks to recent UD grad Joe Cosmetti for his reporting. Next, we hear from senior Madison Gelman, who takes a look at the comeback of the app Yik Yak. The completely anonymous app was previously banned over cyberbullying, but Gelman reports it's now back and on the rise, including at UD.
That's the sound of chatter you'll find on any college campus. But lately, some of that talk is happening somewhere a bit more anonymous. Yik Yak, the once banned app, is back, and students at UD are using it more than ever.
It's sort of like a anonymous site where you can express your opinions and, you know, just say whatever you want. People can upvote it or downvote it and comment on it within a 5-mile radius, and it's like really popular among college campuses.
That was Kaylee Uzbe, a senior at UD who describes Yik Yak as a place where students share daily thoughts. But sometimes those posts can get controversial.
Most of the stuff is like trying to be relatable. Like, I just broke up with my girlfriend, I'm sad. Or they'll say, oh, is it hot outside? Do I need to wear a tank top or a sweatshirt? But then it gets a little bit like controversial sometimes. Sometimes they name drop people and just like express negative opinions about certain people or certain groups on campus. And that's when it can get kind of messy.
From my perspective, I have seen the damage this stuff does to students.
UD human behavior professor John Groth says the privacy is the attraction, but warns there is a dark side.
You could put something that was really mean, and because it's anonymous and nobody knows who wrote it, there's like 20, 50 students who could go, that's directed at me. And you've actually done so much damage.
Groth says that without names or faces, comments can hit harder, something Kaylee knows about firsthand.
I've been targeted a few times on Yik Yak just because I run Airband for my sorority. So a lot of people can get very judgmental and very rude, just outright rude.
For Kaylee, the rudeness expanded to personal attacks.
I kind of wore like a bodysuit on stage at Airband, and they were all talking about my body, which was interesting. They weren't saying bad things, but like that's definitely something that stuck in my mind, you know.
Yik Yak came back with new rules, but some old habits are still showing up.
I asked students, and one student said, honestly, it was kind of cool to a little bully people. So I could see where you could get a group of people who maybe get a little alcohol involved and you get your phones out.
Despite the new rules, the app still lets people avoid accountability for the harm they cause.
Student expression is not more important if it's anonymous. I get the First Amendment rights and everything of freedom of speech, but identify who you are.
Yik Yak's return brings back an old question. Can anonymous apps connect us or just divide us? The new rebranded Yik Yak may help connect the campus, but for many at UD, the app doesn't feel all that different from before. For the University of Delaware News, I'm Madison Gelman.
Thanks to UD senior Madison Gelman for her piece. And we close with rising senior Chris Granada, who notes that graduation last month was full of additional stress and uncertainty for international students at UD. As visa rules tighten and immigration policies shift, Granada reports the path from diploma to career has never felt more unclear for these students.
Scared because I feel like we don't have the correct pathway to like be able to stay here if we want to.
Petros Focas is one of many international students at the University of Delaware. For Focas and others, graduation is supposed to be a celebration, the reward for years of hard work and sacrifice. But for many, it marks the beginning of a new set of worries. As the caps and gowns are ordered, an uneasy reality sets in and puts the thought that what happens next is far from certain. In the U.S., international students are most often on F-1 visas. The status allows a period of post-graduation work through a program called Optional Practical Training, or what's commonly known as OPT. For some, it's 12 months. For others, particularly in the STEM field, there's a possibility of extension up to 3 years. The extra time can make a difference, offering a chance to build experience, secure a job, and make the American dream a reality. Unfortunately, with the change in administration and recent crackdown by federal immigration authorities and the national tightening visa regulations, that path feels less secure. For now, students like Carlos Fernandez, a biochemistry grad student, feels fortunate to have the extra time to ride out the ever-changing policies.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me feel great, honestly, but honestly, I don't know. I think it's a bit unfair that people who have other majors like don't have the opportunity to get those 2 extra years. But so, yeah, I mean, right now is what it is. I'm happy that I have those extra 2 years.
Even students who've done everything right, maintained their status, aced their classes, and landed job offers can find themselves in a tricky place. Those in non-STEM fields like arts, businesses, or education are particularly unprotected. Without extended OPT or employer sponsorship, many face the real possibility of being sent home just as they're getting started. At UD, students from around the world are feeling the weight of that uncertainty. For some, it's a question of timing. For others, like Petros Focas, it's a question of whether he'll even get to stay long enough to use his degree.
I'm really enjoying being here. And as we said before, I only still have like 1 year left in my visa. So it's actually a mess because imagine spending 3 years of your life trying to adjust, learn something new, and then you have to go back from where you came from.
Coming from Cyprus, a small island off the coast of Greece, and coming to the U.S. to study was the ultimate dream, the American dream, an opportunity not just to learn, but to build a life. For UD international students, as commencement nears, the mood on campus is complicated. The real question on the minds of many international upcoming grads, it's not just what job will I get, it's also, will I even be allowed to try it?
So the visa right now is only for 4 years. And I gave up my whole family, for example. I learned a new culture here. And when I go back home every time, I feel different. The place doesn't feel different, but I feel different because of the new culture and of everything that I've been here. And I just feel like there is not the best.
Reporting from Newark, for UD News, I'm Chris Granada.
Thanks to UD student journalist Chris Granada, Madison Gelman, and Joe Cosmetti for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, UD student journalist Joe Cosmetti, Madison Gelman, and Chris Granada. and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first date of mind.